This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. We're in Chicago for a passing of the torch at the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden has urged Americans to elect Kamala Harris as his replacement. But what will President Biden do with the time he has left in office? And what is the legacy he wants to leave? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show.
This morning, a serving, it's very rare you get a serving police officer speaking openly on the radio, but this man is concerned about the impact that the job has on officers. He's very, very praiseworthy, actually, of the PSNI. He says it's his family, but you're going to hear the real psychological impact having a job in policing, as well as the good stuff, the burden that it has on some officers. And then a discussion around the mental health support that is or is not there. This, of course, in the context of the Prime Minister flying into Northern Ireland yesterday. He didn't commit to more money. He said he had talks about it. Well, what's that mean? Is he handing the chequebook over or not? And if he's not, is Stormont going to hand the chequebook over? And if they're not, then is Boucher going to have to cut his cloth? All coming up on today's programme.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Morning, everyone. The headline message the NIO wants you to hear today is that the Prime Minister flew into Northern Ireland yesterday and thanked the police officers who were injured in the riots. The photo op that you will have seen over the last 24 hours is of John Boucher, the Chief Constable, shaking hands with the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer. So while Mr. Starmer, our Prime Minister, is very much wanting you to be thinking of how he is supporting the police, came all the way to Northern Ireland to do so, the reality is that is the same man who flew into Northern Ireland and did not commit to any more funding for the police service here, despite the guy who was shaking his hand, John Boucher, saying that the situation with the funding is deplorable and that his force have been left abandoned. And then you read between the lines of what Sir Keir Starmer said about funding. Have a listen.
I do think it's very important to come and say thank you. It's very important for the Prime Minister to come here to talk to the frontline officers face to face and humbly say thank you for what they and their colleagues have done, as I say, many of them injured. But of course, we've also had discussions about resourcing, about capability. Mainly, of course, that's a devolved issue, as I think everybody understands. But nonetheless, we've had that discussion about what further support can go in, whether that's financial or whether it's in other ways in terms of making sure the system works better. But my main purpose was to come and say thank you. But of course, those discussions have been had, as you would expect them to be had, about the wider support, both immediately and in the medium and long term.
Maybe it's a devolved issue, as everyone understands. Well, the Prime Minister knows everyone doesn't agree with that, because the majority of the political parties here have their hand out and are asking Starmer to put more money into policing in Northern Ireland. So that's the first thing. The second thing is he then drops a little bit of hope. He says we've had discussions whether it's financial or by other means. So what is going on? Has John Boucher been promised any more money? I think we'll need to ask the PSNI that question. There's a wee phone, I think, in the PSNI press office, and the Nolan ring bell goes on every day. So what was that discussion? Is John Boucher any more hopeful after his discussions with the Prime Minister yesterday? And then this, some people would describe it as very, very interesting comment from the Chief Constable himself, where he essentially tells the MLAs that they'll not be getting much of a break as soon as they come back, because he's after them.
With regards to the money, look, it's a period where everybody seems to be away. It's a holiday period. We know Stormont's not sitting. They came back to call out the unacceptable nature of what we've seen on the streets of Northern Ireland. When they get back in September, I'll be waiting and I'll be talking to them about the issues that I've highlighted to the PM and to them previously. But they need to be funded to need, and we then need to get our share of that money, which hasn't happened for some time.
When they get back in September, I'll be waiting. So how's Gavin Robinson going to deal with that? A chief constable saying, I'm waiting for you when you get back to work. How's Michelle O'Neill? Sinn Féin now support the PSNI. Michelle O'Neill is protected by the PSNI. So how's Sinn Féin going to deal with a chief constable say, I'm waiting for you when you get back to work? And Naomi Long, the Justice Minister. What are they going to do? Are they going to stomp up more money for the police, or are they going to say to Boucher, you've got what you've got, deal with it? And if that's the case, what will our PSNI look like? What will our police force look like? So Michelle O'Neill, as our First Minister, rightly so, if she's in trouble, if she needs protected, if someone tries to endanger Michelle O'Neill, there is a close protection PSNI team around her. There's no close protection PSNI team around someone that's getting beaten up in a domestic abuse situation. And if there aren't enough police to race to that house, if there aren't enough police to investigate it, then what does Northern Ireland start to look like? You look at those riots recently and those officers standing there getting battered by rioters. What do we do in emergency situations if we don't have enough money? Or does John Boucher, like the ministers in government who wish for more money and they ain't getting it, does he just have to cut his cloth? Is it an unrealistic situation where he's warning these politicians that he'll be waiting for them when they're all off on holiday in August and coming back in September? 030 30 80 55 55. There's actually lots of talking points from those statements that were made by both the Prime Minister and John Boucher yesterday, and we'll talk about them today. Before we do so, though, what we want to do in this programme is make this as real as possible as to what is it like on the front line in policing. What is it like when you are under so much stress because of the job? And so usually on a programme like this, we have people who are past police officers talking to us. This morning, it's an extraordinary first-hand account from a current serving officer. We're going to call him Paul for security reasons. He's contacted me about the scale of the mental health crisis in the PSNI. Remember, current officers are having to wait for up to 9 months for mental health specialist support. 9 months. There are 357 officers off sick due to mental health. It's unusual for a serving officer to do an interview with the media. You're going to hear from one today. This detective sergeant has investigated some of the most serious crimes here: murder, rape and child abuse. And some of those incidents, some of those traumatic images are locked in his mind, and he hasn't been able to sleep, and he hasn't been able to function like he wants to. He's speaking out today because he wants to help other officers who he says are in the same boat. Let's have a listen.
Stephen, this past, I would say, 10 months has probably been the most challenging for me in my life. And I'm 50 years of age. And as a police officer serving within the PSNI, you know, I've had a number of recent and non-recent stressors in my life relating to duty-related investigations and things that I've attended over the years. And I transferred into a subsection of Crime Branch last year, in the middle of the year. And when I got there, it was a significant resourcing issue was, it became immediately apparent to me, like on day one. And I worked through it, and like many people in life...
Is this recent?
Yeah. I went there last, at the end of the summer last year, and then it all came to a head at the start of this year in January time. And I actually, the stress, it just, I burned out. The stress, I thought I was taking a heart attack. A friend came around and was concerned, took me to hospital. Ended up on resus. Now, thankfully, it wasn't anything like a heart attack, but blood pressure, stress, anxiety, panic attacks had taken over, basically.
And how do you get to that point in your job rather than just you walk away? You think, I've done my work. It's not my fault. It's not resourced properly. I'm walking away.
Stephen, I always wanted to be a police officer. And I like to, I'm a people person and I care about people. And that was my motivation. It might sound like a cliche, but I genuinely wanted to do it because I wanted to do some good and help people. Throughout my career, I've been involved in murder investigations, terrorism, child abuse investigations, rape crime. And I've seen how, just having that outlet and that avenue for victims to come and actually, tell their story, so to speak, and give their evidence and get off their chest what happened to them those years ago. And I'm motivated by that, just to try and continue on. Now, I'll admit that when I actually ended up in hospital in January, about four days later, I had already been seeing a psychologist about other duty-related matters that I had attended many years ago. And it all came crashing in. I think the moment I stopped, the moment I ended up having to go off sick, everything else came tumbling in, and I hit an awful depression. And I woke up on the Thursday morning. I went into the hospital on the Saturday night. And on the Thursday morning, I woke up, and I didn't see the next day.
What do you mean?
I wasn't going to do anything to myself, but I was afraid. I couldn't see the future. And I was worried about what that would mean in the long term if I didn't address that. And one of the reasons why I speak out now is because it's hard for anybody to talk about mental health, but it's, I think, more so difficult for men. And throughout my service, even whenever I was the senior constable, say, in the local response section, they call it LPT now, when we went to a particularly harrowing incident, a suicide, a murder, you're doing those first responses, you're seeing it as it's unfolding. And you carry a lot. We're human beings, we're blood and flesh and bone. But people don't seem to maybe see that whenever they see the uniform. And I always said to the younger people that come into section, are you okay? If not, speak up. I'm here for you.
Can you give me, let's walk through this. You say that you were getting professional help for something you encountered in the past. Was that one incident that haunted you?
There has been a few things in my service, three things in particular. And I'm conscious of the nature of those. I don't want to be sharing too much graphic information on.
Can you share the broad basis of it, so we can understand?
There was a murder I went to when I used to work in Old Park Police Station in North Belfast. I went to a murder. I was the first responder there, and it was a young person. And it has lived with me and resonated with me ever since.
What has lived with you?
I think the thing that gets me most is I don't want to sound insensitive, but you get used to seeing blood, and you get used to dealing with people who have passed away, died, and some of the circumstances obviously vary drastically. But I think what got me more was the grief of the family and seeing them being exposed to that. The frequent dreams would come and it would disturb my sleep.
Dreams of what?
I can hear people crying. I can hear family crying. And, and it takes me back to the scene, and I can see family over his body. It's hard to process.
Was he a child?
Well, a teenager. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to identify.
That's fair enough.
Family or nothing like that, but yeah, I suppose in many ways I've always felt a degree of responsibility for their grief, and I don't know why. I took the mother to where he was, knowing that it was not a good scene to see. But I just wanted them to be able to say "I love you" before he was gone, you know, and the grief and that maybe brought about or exacerbated for that lady. I thought I was doing the right thing, and I hope it was the right thing. But I was never able to get past that. You know, I've often wondered, you know, what does she think? Does she think I was wrong in doing that? I made it worse for her. I don't know. I never got over it.
So that's a guilt.
Yeah.
An irrational guilt that, because you were doing your job, that's all. But that's a guilt that has locked into your mind.
Yeah, I think the thing that gets me most is families and the grief that they suffer at the hands of other people's, you know, criminal acts, you know, where they've lost a loved one. Another one involves a suicide in North Belfast, you know, and again, it's the mother. I can hear that the mother was there, and whenever I broke into the flat, and she screamed like I can only describe it as a high pitched scream. Whenever we found him, and again, I just really struggle with that. So do.
How long ago has that been locked in your mind for?
Good 17 years.
My goodness.
And at the time, you know, things have changed for the good in the PSNI. I've nothing bad to say about the PSNI. They're like family. And we support one another. But the support has got better as the years have gone by. And I'm in the police now. I'm in my 22nd year. And what I would say is it's a fantastic organisation. And I'm honoured to be part of it. Peer support has been set up. You talked about that in your programme last week with, I think, the Blue Line charity.
Yeah.
Isn't that right? You know, they're there and they're great. Our occupational health, I've heard people say that it takes a while. Yes, it does, because whenever I went to see, asked to see a psychologist, it took me 9 months before I got an appointment. But they're not an emergency service and they have their own commitments, and I stand on their side. The service I got was 5-star. And when I ultimately took ill and burned out at the start of this year, they could not have done enough for me.
Can I ask you, sorry to interrupt, but the PS and I have told the Nolan Show themselves that there is a 9-month wait for psychological care. That's current present day figure.
Mm-hmm.
When you've described two of the incidents there that continue all these years later, decades later, to traumatise you, is it acceptable that there is not more resource so that you don't wait 9 months? Is it on?
I think, Stephen, I suppose you have to take a realistic approach to these things, you know. Albeit we're, you know, down to 6,350 officers, it's still a sizable number of people that one team in occupational health have to look after. And I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong either. I think we just have to be a bit of understanding of the cans and can't do's, you know. I can't say a bad thing. Like, whenever my mental health really took a decline at the start of this year, see when I really needed them, I just had to lift the phone. Even if I didn't have an appointment for, say, 8 weeks to see them, if I was hitting a particularly bad time, all I had to do was lift the phone. And what I would say to any officer out there even if you have an appointment and you have to wait for it, if you're really bad and you need to reach out, lift the phone and call them. And if, you know, they've just been brilliant. I don't know where I would be here today without them. I really don't.
Do you have a world-class psychological support on hand? Is that what the PSNI officers do or don't have? I am hearing from officers who say that that is not there.
From my experience, I believe that there is a fantastic support service there with access to psychologists and mental health treatments. In terms of the time that it gets to take that or to, you know, to access that, you know, I suppose there's always room for improvement, you know, but I'm trying to be realistic about that as well. You know, like if I had have known to ask for help 17 years ago, perhaps I wouldn't be dealing with the issues that I am faced with in current day.
You mentioned that, Paul, there are three issues. You've told us about two. What's the other?
When I worked in child abuse investigations back about 12 years ago, infant deaths, yeah. The infant deaths are hard. They're hard on the family.
You mean when children are deliberately killed?
No, one in particular was a sudden infant death, you know, and a family wakes up and... sorry, Stephen, it's just a wee bit hard to talk about that one. dealing with the death of any young child, let alone a baby, is extremely challenging, let alone what the family must be going through. And it involves very close contact with the family at the early stages when it's very raw.
So what you're experiencing that leads to trauma is the emotional impact on those who are left behind when someone dies.
Yeah, it's like you are exposed to a lot of it, and that's not a criticism of family or anyone like that. It's natural. But as police officers, you know, we have to deal with, and we are exposed to a lot of that. And I suppose maybe if the system was capable, this isn't a criticism, but if the system was obviously more capable, then maybe we could be seen sooner. You know, I certainly know now that supervisors have a duty placed upon them to actually offer welfare to officers who have been exposed to any traumatic events.
But if there is, and look, I know that you're being very loyal to the organisation that you so covet, and I'm not trying to undo that in any way. But I'm hearing today of the acute human impact there is on someone like you, and you don't sound to me like you have an agenda against the PSNI. Completely opposite.
No, none
you're,
at
you're,
all.
You're protecting them. But if we as society are making someone like you wait 9 months to get help, what damage is that doing? I think that's a fair question.
It would be a fair question. I wish I had have had access to the treatment center. But the PSNI that I joined and the PSNI that it is today are vastly different. You know, I joined at the start of 2003. And in terms of support and welfare, it's very much, you know, to the fore in the organization now. It wasn't really talked about whenever I first joined the police, certainly for the first 10 years of my, maybe 15 years of my service, it wasn't really a thing. I'm not saying it was never there, certainly to my knowledge, but it has come very much to the fore. You know, there is regular emails and videos on our intranet system, you know, offering the services and talking about them. And they do encourage people to come forward.
For me, looking from the outside in, and look, I doubt I'd be on the Christmas card list of the police very often, that this programme challenges the police on a regular basis.
Yeah.
But I had an opportunity recently to experience what an officer goes through, just from a very, very far distance. And for me, what I hadn't thought about was the obvious. They go from one traumatic event to the other, and it's not natural as a human being. So as a human being, if I have something that's upsetting in my life, it might take me a couple of days to recover. These officers are going from one incident, you and your colleagues, to the next, to the next, to the next, within the same day.
Yeah,
you must be pushing back the forces of normal human reaction when you go on to, right, that's done, now I'm going off to another disaster, now I'm going off to another human trauma event.
Yeah, you sort of put that police hat on, and it's almost like, right, this is a job, you get on with it. You carry it home with you. You know, like, you carry it home with you, and it affects your home life if you're not careful. You know, like for me, I would have trouble with concentration and recall, memory. And I think a lot of that is intricately linked to trauma. And I think it's my mind, I suppose, trying to block things out. But then I find myself often distracted and difficult to focus on current day at times, you know. And that's what I've been trying to work through to try and fix as well.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, and it's something that the Chief Constable's, John Boucher's, openly talked about, the pressure on the police because of a lack of resources. Now, John Boucher went so far, he didn't pull any punches. In the policing board recently, he said he thinks the pressure of the job led to someone taking their own life, and he said he's worried about that happening again. How much is a lack of resources a real danger to the lives of police officers?
I think every police force needs to be adequately resourced. I've met Mr. Boucher, and I have a lot of time for him. Since he joined the organisation, there has been a wind of change that has swept through it, and he's restored, I think, a lot of confidence from officers and staff. And I believe, you know, it's a matter for him to obviously address, which he's doing very well. But it's like anything in life, if you don't have the appropriate resources, then you're going to struggle. And those that are in the mix are going to feel that pressure.
But let's talk about you. You can give me a real life experience. How much has it affected your mental health, not being resourced properly?
Yeah, like, so you try to work through it as best you can and hoping that it'll always get better, but it was only gradually getting worse. And no one likes to speak up and admit the defeat, you know. So it was very embarrassing and humiliating in the end. I seriously questioned my future in the police. I've come back to another department as an interim measure just because of my illness. So I'm not currently frontline. And I have to say, when I did come back, I was off for almost 4 months. When I eventually did come back, they were very good at supporting me, and still are. But I did have some real ropey moments for the first few weeks. I actually thought I was going to have to leave.
Why? What
happened? I just didn't know whether I could go through that stress again. I'll be honest with you, Nolan, the only way I could describe it was I thought it was going to kill me. I thought my heart was going to give in, or I was going to have a stroke. I thought maybe my mind was, I felt like I was losing my marbles.
Because I know at one stage in the past, in a particular crime department you were in, you were the only senior officer for the whole of Northern Ireland. Is that right? on duty?
Well, I make no secret. I'm a sergeant. I'm a DS. And on weekdays, the on-call system would have put you on your own for the whole of Northern Ireland, covering Northern Ireland for any live matters. Now, the night I ultimately ended up in hospital, I think I'd worked about 17 or 18 hours, and new referrals were coming in hand over fist, and I had no, you know, I tried to get some support. I ran out of options, and thankfully an inspector called me, and she was able to get someone to take over whilst I went to the hospital.
So you'd been working 17, 18 hours flat out, is that right?
Yeah, like that's not uncommon in some departments. Like I think the longest shift I've ever worked is 36 hours.
36 hours without sleep?
Well, I slept in riot kit on the floor of Tennant Street Canteen for about 2 hours, but I wouldn't exactly call it sleep. but, you know, last September when I first went to the department that you're referring to, I done 24 hours straight from the Sunday morning through to the Monday morning, and I was still online, navigating investigations and resources.
And what's the level of, when you're a sergeant in that role where you say you were the only person on call in the whole of Northern Ireland, what type of decisions are you making?
So you're thinking of your, we call it the golden hour opportunities. You know, the first hour of any crime is vital to securing the best possible evidence and potentially locating suspects and preserving forensic material. So it's a lot of time critical.
Yeah, but because I don't understand. So you're sitting in a base somewhere. Mm-hmm. You're the only person in Northern Ireland doing what?
So, as a sergeant in a crime department, you know, there has to be call 24/7. So out of office hours, for example, if it was a child abuse matter or a rape matter, or even a murder, you would be the first person to get called when the crews 999 turn up. They would call the DS for that department and say, look, we've got a job in here, here's the circumstances. And it's up to that sergeant to make those early decisions in relation to the deployment and allocation of resource, making sure that the scenes are set up and identified properly, making sure that any referrals to, say, the Sexual Assault Referral Centre are made. But you're doing all this yourself, you know, those referrals. So it's about getting the right information, making good, sound decisions.
And do things like that come in time, incidents like that, do they come in on top of each other?
Yeah.
In one period?
There was three running that night for me alone. Three live incidents and outstanding suspects.
Serious incidents?
Yeah. You would get a life sentence for some of those crimes.
What were they?
Rape.
And is the mental stress the pressure of not making a mistake? Is that it? Or is it on being in your own, or what is it?
Well, it's both, because, you know, ultimately the Code of Ethics and the Police Act demand that police officers investigate and prevent crime. And when we investigate, we do it well. And with any high-level investigation, a serious matter requires a higher standard. And that's why sergeants are directed and put in place to make those decisions, because they can't always be made by a constable at the front line.
So and it was that night wrong, you got sick, is it?
Well, my sickness was sort of building over the period of about two to 3 months. But it was that night that I ultimately ended up at hospital. You know, it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot expected of a member of the team. And I think, you know, it's not a criticism of the department. I think the department, they're left with what they have. And even though I raised my concerns and my symptoms, like some 7 weeks beforehand. The, you know, it's not a criticism of any supervisor of me, but their hands were tied and limited in terms of what they could do because there was no quick fix to that.
Well, you've been very, very kind, but there is a question there. If you're referring something, you're saying I'm sick, and 7 weeks later, you're still under intense pressure. There's something wrong in the system, is there not?
Resource, it comes down to officer numbers and staff numbers, doesn't it?
Well, do you know what? And I'm not allowed to express my opinion, so I'm constrained in what I can say here, but I'll say it like this. I doubt, because of the nature of the Nolan Show, I'm sure that this programme frustrates the hell out of John Boucher, right? He's a new chief constable. I don't know him. I'm not friendly with him. But I've seen many different chief constables come and go over the years. And they have different skills and all of that. Communication and being able to actually connect with both the rank and file of the PSNI and being able to connect with the public is so important. And I've seen quite a few chief constables who couldn't do it. Boucher can. He's got that skill. The question is, will he use it to maximum effect? How long are you guys going to have that guy? And you know, what's he going to be able to change in terms of you feeling supported with resources and your colleagues?
Well, I'll tell you what he's done for me, because I wrote to Mr. Boucher whenever I was still sick to highlight my experience. And he offered to meet me, and he met me and gave me a full hour of his time. And that's the chief constable of PSNI, who probably doesn't have the time of day to himself with his rules and responsibilities. And certainly, I feel inspired and supported by him. The very fact that he would go out of his way to listen to a sergeant many ranks lower than him, that man cares. And if Mr. Boucher is listening to this programme and on a future date, I want him to know that I certainly feel that he has secured the support and the confidence of many officers and staff just because he has that caring nature, and he has that, he's fighting their corner.
But the question is, and I would say this to his face if I'm ever interviewing him, what are his list of goals that he can be held accountable in 12 months' time, 2 years' time, in terms of what's he going to deliver? So there's absolutely no doubt that guy has top of the range communication skills. I've seen it. I sat with him for a brief period of time, and he could talk me out of the room. He could be funnier. He's got it in terms of communication. The question is, what's he going to leave behind when he goes in a few years' time? Is he going to bring more money to this place? Is he going to bring more confidence within the rank and file that they are supported? Because this is a difficult place to police, as you know.
Yeah, it is, and it's challenging with the different security issues that the PSNI face here as opposed to anywhere else in the UK. But ultimately, you know, I think he's doing all he can to try and secure that extra funding to bring us back to where we need to be.
Yeah.
Sure. It ultimately lies with other people, though, in terms of releasing that. And I can't really, and I don't really want to get involved in
that. Yeah, but what if he doesn't get it?
Politicians, but
what if he doesn't get the money?
I would hate to think. Like, when I joined the police, we had in excess of, I think we had about 8,000 regular police officers, and then we had about 1,800 full-time reserve. There was near 10,000 police officers in Northern Ireland when I joined. And you can see and feel the difference now, most definitely. And it has progressively become more like that throughout my service. You notice it in other crime departments as well. I've been in crime departments now for about 14 years.
That's a serving police officer speaking to us yesterday. A different perspective now from an officer who is not serving, has left the police, and we've been hearing from a number of police officers telling us that the old days in both the RUC and the PSNI at the beginning, things have improved, but for them, if they're out of the force, there is no help for them. So that first officer we've heard from, a lot of praise for the help they get, not so much praise from Robert, who got in touch with us.
There's none. Effectively, prior to leaving, if you do leave under something relating to post-traumatic stress disorder, you will receive or you will attend meetings with a psychiatrist. Most of that's about assessing your condition for your medical discharge. Very little of it is about advising you what you should do thereafter. The minute you get your certificate, you're effectively medically discharged. All that treatment from Occupational Health Service ends. There's no treatment from them, or I received no treatment from thereafter. And in fact, they didn't even signpost me to any form of treatment. So it's almost like when you get medically discharged, I was medically discharged for anxiety state and loss of hearing. The anxiety state wasn't even explained to me. Whenever the officer came out to inform me I was being medically discharged, I asked him what anxiety state was, because it never had been mentioned before. I couldn't explain it. He couldn't even explain it. And also, then once I went off, that's it. It was like you're healed from that point, but you're actually not healed from that point. You're still sick. But there was no cure whatsoever. Then I was informed at a later stage, many years afterwards, Police Rehabilitation Retraining Trust, which has a counselling service, I had to literally beg to get onto it. And they initially refused me. They did an assessment on the phone. 3 days later, came back to me and said, you're on a waiting list. And the waiting list, who knows how long the waiting list was. So I at that point, I just was sick of it. I said, look, I'm not, just remove me from the system, because it's not helping having these negative thoughts of being sort of turned away or turned down. So then they made space for me. I received counselling for a few months, and then over a summer period between work and holiday, I didn't get any counselling, which was fine. I had no issues with that. But when I came back to them in the autumn time, I was told that I had to go through the whole assessment. So I had to go through, relive all the things, talk about why I felt I needed counselling. I was then given 4 appointments, which were leading up to Christmas of last year. I was given 4 appointments, physically given them over the phone, the dates and the times, which were leading up to Christmas. 5 minutes later, I was phoned back by Police Rehabilitation Training Trust. The counsellor said, "Oh, I've spoken to my line manager, and you're not high enough on the list, so we can't do this." So he's cancelled within 5 minutes. Cancelled all 4 sessions.
And how much help do you think you needed? How bad were you?
How bad was I? So I'm having flashbacks, I'm having nightmares, I'm having night sweats, I'm basically living incident or the incident and other incidents. I'm hyper alert all the time. I was days I couldn't even physically get out of bed. I couldn't cope with the situation. So if that's not, you see, the issue with these organisations, it's almost like an ass covering. All they talk about is they ask you, are you likely to self-harm or harm other people? And once they sort of hear that, it almost gives them there's wriggle room here. We can put this guy on a list. We can put him on a waiting list. Well, I was never going to harm myself or harm anybody else. I've never thought like that at all. But that doesn't mean that I haven't got needs. And that was a problem. So that was the question that was previously asked. Are you likely to harm yourself, or are you likely to harm somebody else?
How long, Robert, had you been a police officer?
I'd been a police officer for 16 years. And so I had been through many, many different incidents. And I really don't want to discuss them, because I don't really want to identify myself on the programme. But I have to say, I can fully understand why there's not retention in the police, and there's no great amount of people want to apply. What? An organisation that does not look after its officers when they're working for them and when they're left is never going to retain or never going to recruit people.
And look, I understand that you don't want to relive the fine detail. I get that. But so that the public can understand why you needed the help. Can you give me examples, broad examples of what you were getting flashbacks over?
Okay, so
road traffic incidents or
no. First year and a half of my service, eight work colleagues and friends were murdered in three separate incidents. So that's your starter for 10, from a person who's 18, left school, and effectively in their first year and a half of their service. And I continued on from that. I have been to many murder scenes, seen a lot of trauma in my life. And it's like a cup. It just builds up, it builds up and builds up, and then it starts to spill.
And when you say flashbacks of what?
Flashbacks to the actual incident. You can actually feel, you can sense, you can smell what you experienced at the time.
Are you talking about dead bodies or what?
Of course I'm talking about dead bodies. And I want to be careful because I don't want to actually physically say too much that then it has an impact on the families of those individuals.
But are we talking about dead bodies of people who had been murdered or road traffic accidents? What?
No,
give me a sense
murdered.
Of what a... Murdered.
Murdered. Murdered. And bomb and shooting incidents.
Can you help me understand? I think I understand. But sometimes we dehumanise emergency services to the point where that's their job, so we expect it to have no effect on them. That's the purpose of my question. That's the intent. There's no intent other than that.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're in a job and you arrive at a scene and you're seeing a human being who has been shot or the physicality of a human body which has been blown up or murdered, do you get used to it?
No, I don't think. If you did, wouldn't be human.
So what does it do to you? What does it do to your brain? I've never arrived at such a scene. I would be sick. But what does it do to you?
Well, you see, you work in the police, you work in an all mostly male society, so that we have this sort of macho nonsense where you have to hold it together, and that's expected of you, and you don't talk about your emotions. And then people refer to liquid Valium, you know, using alcohol to dull the effects thereafter. And you know, I mean, PTSD and these things relates back to the First and Second World War, relates back to Vietnam, but somehow it was never seemed to be understood here, and it was never something that was dealt with, because it was just something that was swept onto the carpet, and hopefully it will go away. My experience of the police is that they're good to attach. They like attaching themselves to things that are, you know, valuable things that bring glory. But any sort of mess at all, they sweep it under the carpet. Don't want to deal with it. Don't look at it. Don't talk about it. And hopefully it will go away. And I'll tell you what, most of the problems that I would say that a lot of officers experience is not the incidents themselves. It's the lack of support. That's one of the biggest things.
Did you get to the stage where you experienced these traumatic events and you didn't realise it was building up, and then you do realise? Is that how it happens, or what happens?
No, you don't realise it's building up, but you're like a cup being filled with water, and there's only so much you can actually take, and then at a point, that's when you break, and that's when the cup, then all the water leaks out of the cup.
And when you say break, so you're then at home, you're getting flashbacks of these incidents you've been at, you can't sleep. Is that the symptoms of this?
Well, it's some of the symptoms that I experience: sleepless nights, not being able to sleep the entire night, lying in bed, sense of lack of worth, sense of purpose, not being able to get out of your bed in the morning, not because you were lazy, but you just didn't feel like getting out of bed, but you didn't actually know what to do, because I don't even know what a mental breakdown is. I'm not saying I had one, but nobody explains what you actually should experience or feel. So if you don't know what to experience or feel, you don't really know what's going on in your life at that point.
And so, Robert, at some point, did you reach out to the police while you were in service, or was it afterwards?
No, it was afterwards. It was afterwards because it was never, none of this was ever mentioned. I mean, I wasn't even a receipt of an injury and duty pension for many years after I left because it wasn't even offered to me. I didn't even know it existed.
So you just left because of age, or you left because of...
No, I was medically discharged, but when I was medically discharged, nobody told me there was a financial assistance. So I went from a fairly good wage to 10%. I went to 10% of what I was earning. That was what my pension was when I left, 10% of what I'd been earning when I left. And then it was only when I got the injury and duty pension a number of years later that helped me, because otherwise I was having financial difficulty. So the talk about, we are talking about these things, we've improved our processes, they haven't. That's completely.
And you
incorrect.
Were medically discharged because of your mental health,
discharged.
Is that right?
I was medically for anxiety state. On my certificate was anxiety state and loss of hearing. And I didn't even know that was coming in advance. When I was told it was loss of hearing, and then when I was medically discharged, this said anxiety, and I asked for an explanation. It was only later on that a letter was sent to my GP saying that I was suffering from PTSD. Nobody actually said that to me.
And was the loss of hearing because of an incident on police duty?
It was, yes, an incident and also sort of firing weapons on a range. So
how long ago was this? When?
I don't really want to...
Roughly? Are we talking 5, 10, 15 years?
The most recent reaching out for assistance was a couple of years ago. That's the most recent.
Well,
a Police Rehabilitation Retraining Trust would not provide counselling for me because they felt that I was too low down the list. And I say the questions I was repeatedly asked were, was I likely to harm myself or in turn harm other people? And that seemed to be the dividing line. That was where the decision was made on where you were put on the list.
You're being very critical, as you're entitled to be, of the organisation you worked for.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's a possibility of a fresh start under John Boucher? He's a new chief constable. He says he cares about this stuff.
What's he going to do for me? What's he going to do for me? I'm gone. I'm left. So no, there's not going to be any fresh. There might be fresh start for other people, but it's a little bit too late for those who have gone before.
You're clearly angry.
I would say frustrated. Because I loved the police and it felt like a death. I would say I mourned it for 7 or 8 years. I gave my time to it. I served in if you want to say the most extreme places, I served in those places. And I was cast aside like a piece of dirt, just thrown to the ground and forgotten about. My going away day, the most senior rank was a sergeant, but I used to brief chief superintendents. So my most senior person there was a sergeant, and my going away day, and it was a shared going away day, somebody who was going to training or somebody who was going to a different team. Of course I'm angry. I mean, I have a sore. I have a wound that has never, ever been healed. And I'm not even sure how it can be healed, but it's certainly not going to be healed by people continuously disregarding that there's people out there who are hurt by this.
What would your advice be to a young officer joining the police, or indeed any age of officer currently in the force?
I'd say to anybody thinking of joining, don't join. Certainly not under the conditions that I worked under or people worked under since. Because you're a battering ram.
You don't know what the current leadership is doing. That force could have changed.
Let's take the bookie shop incident during COVID, where the two police officers were illegally disciplined. And it actually brought the downfall of the previous chief constable. He was going to challenge it. So tell me where it's changed. So they took a situation which they didn't know anything about, and to appease something within politics, they did wrongly, illegally, as the judge had pointed out, disciplined two officers.
But there is a new chief constable now.
Well there is a new chief constable.
John Boucher is a new chief constable.
Yeah.
You're telling people not to join the police. Do you not want to give him a chance to show what he's about?
Well, let's see. Because as you were mentioning, or somebody, one of your callers yesterday was mentioning about when all it is people shouting or talking, what the Justice Minister talking about. It's all talk. It's all talk at the time, to hopefully that there'll be a new news cycle and this will have disappeared. But talk is one thing, action is another thing, and there's very little action for current officers or former officers who are in the situation that most of us have gone into.
Robert, thank you very, very much for talking to us today. Thank you.
That's all. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Two very different perspectives. One from a serving officer. That guy left 30 years ago, but it doesn't mean he doesn't have the trauma still. And many of those officers who were in the RUC, the PSNI, who's helping them? The Police and Rehabilitation Retraining Trust say in the last year, 222 retired officers, their family members, serving and retired prison officers have presented for treatment with them. There's obviously a big talking point here. Thanks for joining us here at The Nolan Show on the BBC today. Don't forget you can listen to the programme on BBC Sounds. It's there whatever time of day or night that you want to listen to the programme. If you've got a story for us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. In the first hour of the programme, very much trying to get a sense from both past officers and a serving officer of the mental health ramifications of being in the police. I think this feeds into then the debate that we're currently having as to how much funding you do or do not give the police, given the stretch on all of the other different departments and services that need funded in Northern Ireland. If you've been listening to that and you do feel that you need some help talking to someone about the first hour, there is a BBC Action Line for advice and support, bbc.co.uk/action line. So the Ulster Unionist Party leader is no longer the Ulster Unionist Party leader. Doug Beattie has gone. And the Belfast Telegraph is reporting that UUP party officers are meeting this morning to agree a selection process for their new leader. Belfast Telegraph's Alison Morris is with us today. Good morning to you, Alison.
Good morning.
Well, look, these party officers may be meeting, but there's a question now about them and how they handle themselves if leaders don't seem to be able to be given the freedom that a leader should have. So who are these party officers? And are they prepared to do a review of themselves, I wonder, Alison?
Well, we know, and we've seen this in the past with political parties such as the DUP, that when it comes to those sort of party officers, that they can wield the real power within any political party. And so you do have a situation where if we look back probably in political parties, now people like David Trimble, people like Ian Paisley, they initially they would have been the leaders who went back and told the party officers what was happening. And then as time has moved on, we see the people and party leaders, especially when we come to, you know, Geoffrey Donaldson, Gavin Robinson, and then in the UUP, Doug Beattie, that a lot of times that they're having a struggle, I suppose, getting their policies past the party officers. I think the real question isn't just, you know, will they give the new leader the freedom to do what they want, is that who wants to be the new leader of the Ulster Unionist Party? That's the real story at this point in time, because there was hardly, you know, a stampede of people wanting to be the leader previously. And given the fact that most of the sort of senior members of the Ulster Unionist Party that you can think of off the top of your head have already had a period as party leader and decided it was no longer for them. So there's a limited pool of people that can be picked from.
You would have thought, therefore, that there is a distinct possibility that anybody considering that job will be wanting to know from the party officers if they're going to be allowed to lead. Like, we haven't heard from Doug Beattie yet, but these, what do they say, irreconcilable differences between him and the party officers, they will eventually hear from him. What does that mean? What weren't they allowing him to do? And will they follow that the next time? What's the point of being a leader if you can't make decisions?
I imagine we will hear from Doug Beattie, because one of the things that his leadership, and I don't think that any journalist can say, that he made himself available for interviews.
100%. Sometimes absolutely.
Those interviews were incredibly tough. And even when he himself was under fire, he still would have showed up and made himself available. And sometimes to his detriment, I think, as well. You know, he was probably too forthcoming and too honest in terms of what way he handled that. And maybe that was one of the problems that the party officers had with Doug Beattie, in the fact that he was someone who was a little too probably upfront when it came to dealing with the media. He wasn't someone who engaged in spin. I remember a long time ago someone saying he needs to learn how to spin a line, and that just wasn't him. Do you know what I mean? It's not the kind of person that he is. He just, he says what he thinks at that particular time, you know, whether it's good or bad. They're maybe going to be looking for someone who is slightly more, maybe a bit more cautious when it comes to that type of engagement. But, I mean, you know, we've been through the list of runners and riders. It's difficult to see who it is going to be.
Chris McGimsey is also with us this morning, former Ulster Unionist Party councillor and commentator. Good morning to you, Chris.
Good morning, Stephen.
Are the party officers looking for a poodle and they'll put the poodle on a leash and walk it? Or are they looking for someone that's going to stand up tall and the leader will lead? What are those party, I keep going on with these party officers, what are they actually looking for?
Well, I mean, what the party officers will do is they will decide the way in which the method of selecting a new leader. These party officers change every year, but the membership of the party will decide who the new leader is. Obviously, if you had the endorsement of the assembly team and the endorsement of the officers, it would be very hard to defeat someone with those sort of endorsements. But, I mean, you know, the party officers will decide the structure and decide the methodology.
Who are they? And
there's a number of
them. Have we heard of any of them? Who are they?
Oh, you'll have heard of them. Well, I couldn't tell you them all off the top of my head. But, I mean, like, the party officers would include the chairman, Jill McCauley, the vice chairman, Jim Nicholson, a number of others who would be probably somebody representing the councillors, something like that. It's quite a democratic structure. The drawback is that the Ulster Unionist Party has been shrinking a little bit. It's financially in difficulties, and the branch structure has started in some areas to collapse, and. You know, there's a growing frustration amongst all members, not just, I mean, they say the grassroots, it sounds like that's something awful. That's the average Joe Bloggs who pays us £30 a year is one of the grassroots. And these people are becoming more and more frustrated.
Alison, if there is not a definite front runner, does that suggest the party's in trouble?
Well, you know, I do think that the Ulster Unionist Party have been in trouble for a while. I mean, at one stage they looked an almost unstoppable decline, and I know that they had a success in the Westminster elections, and they now have an MP again in Robin Swan. Maybe he could be enticed back to be leader again, I'm not sure. But the fact is that there are a party sort of at war with itself. There are people pulling in different directions. So there's the very traditional roots of the Ulster Unionist Party, which was a conservative right-wing unionist party. And then they're the modernisers and the people who think to survive, they have to change and have a real point of difference from the DUP. And the two are sort of pulling in different directions.
You say, go ahead.
And the question is, which sort of faction will the new leader come from? Will they come from that more conservative faction, or will they be, you know, someone who wants to modernise the party?
You say that they're in trouble. I can tell you now, and I can't get the timing of it precise in my head. I'm 51 today. I've got an excuse. You can send the cake later, Alison.
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much. I think it was about 2 years ago. And look, this is definite. This is fact, because we wouldn't have broadcast it otherwise. The Nolan Show were 100% sure that Geoffrey Donaldson was in talks with Doug Beattie about Geoffrey defecting to the Ulster Unionist Party. He was talking to Beattie about it. And we broadcast that at the time, and some people wondered about our sources. I can tell you now, it's fact. He was in talks with Beattie about it. Is the Ulster Unionist Party in any way attractive for disaffected members of the DUP, Alison?
I think it's probably going to end up the other way around. So what you have to ask yourself, is there really enough room for three unionist parties who sometimes appear to all have the same policies? Or does the Ulster Unionist Party, is this now a time when they're going to have to decide, are they in favour of unionist unity and joining with the DUP and forming one major unionist group? Or do they need to accept that those who are more moderate within their party, especially when it comes to those social issues, and have no interest in that sort of fundamentalist DUP side of unionism, do they then go off on their own Is there then a more moderate unionist party? There is a moderate unionist vote. We know that there are people who are strongly in favour of preserving the union, but have no interest in the DUP's policies when it comes to social issues. They are moderate, but they're also unionists. The problem is that because they were homeless for such a long time, politically homeless and in the wilderness, a lot of those people either don't vote or vote for the Alliance Party. And therefore, that's why we've seen the big bounce of the Alliance in what would have been traditional unionist areas. And they are not coming back. And that's the problem Doug Beattie had. He brought around this new vision, but was he too late? Had he already lost that small, you know, that unionist vote, that moderate liberal unionist vote? Had they already gone to the Alliance?
Christmas, Jim, say, how come the Ulster Unionist Party weren't able to do even better than what they did at recent elections, given the situation the DUP found themselves in, where they were having to come up with very creative language to get themselves out of the reality, which was they told people that they had sorted the Irish Sea border. They told people it was all sorted. That's why they were going back into Stormont. And then Gavin Robinson did a complete U-turn on it. So how come your party, the Ulster Unionist Party, weren't able to really capitalise on that?
Well, that's a question I'm not sure I know the answer to. I mean, you're quite right. The DUP were in difficulties. The people who picked up strength from those DUP difficulties, of course, was Jim Allister and the TUV. The Ulster Unionists had been too timid in their approach to the Belfast Agreement and the Irish Sea border and so on, because they weren't sure what they really wanted to do with those issues. And they were inclined to sit back and watch what was happening. They ceased being non-observer participants and became sort of non-participating observers. And that's no position for any political party to get itself into. So, I mean, I don't accept that there is a sort of a right-wing grassroots versus a liberal elite leadership. I mean, I just don't see that at all. I mean, some of the people who are who were unhappy with Beattie were very moderate, if you like, left of centre, and some of them who were very pro Beattie would have been fairly hardline unionist. So, if we want to use that terminology, it's difficult to try and sort of put everybody in the boxes within the Unionist Party.
You never spoke to Doug Beattie in your life, did you?
I was at a meeting once off the offices of East Belfast, and he came in and joined us, and he sat for about an hour or half an hour or something, and I had a brief, what about this, what about that, and that was it. But no, I never met him.
Do you think?
He was never about, and there was a lot of concern at the last, I mean, I accept that was a broad point about the elections, but I mean, like, there was a real feeling in the constituencies that Doug Beattie didn't get himself out and about the elections for all of our candidates. Obviously, the pressure was obviously on to get Robin in, and Doug seemed to disappear for long periods of time, and that was another issue, particularly west of the province, and where we don't have hardly any MLAs left.
I'm sure Doug would want to give a different version of that. Maybe he was working behind the scenes or wherever he was. We'll give him an opportunity to do so when we do eventually speak to him. Alison, do you have any sense as to whether he was pushed or he said to them, "Stuff you, I'm walking"?
I think it was his decision. You know, I do think that there was obviously issues, and you know, my colleague Sam McBride reported today that a lot of those issues were in terms of the selection process that took place to replace Robin Swan, and he was unhappy with that. And I suppose that is probably maybe the Doug Beattie that we know. You know, someone who, if you know, he says what he thinks, and maybe that was part of his downfall as well. But the I think that the fact is the Unionists probably are at a crossroads now, and who their new leader is will be really important in terms of their future and their future survival. Because, you know, if there's another mistake and another temporary leader and someone who maybe lasts another year or two, you really are looking at the sort of demise almost of the party, and them having to really consider what their future is. And I'm sure, you know, Chris McGimsey doesn't want the next Ulster Unionist Party leader to be the last Ulster Unionist Party leader.
If there is a situation where, you know, and you think about the the figures of experience who haven't been able to make that leadership job work, including Mike Nesbitt, now Doug Beattie, you know, others obviously as well. If the party officers, you know, do want the situation where they dictate the rules, Alison, they dictate what the leader can and can't do, what type of character is Robbie Butler, for example? Is he prepared to tell, if to be told, you're going for a walk this morning, put the lead on?
No, I mean, I don't think that that's the sense, I guess, from Robbie Butler at all. The problem, I think, that in terms, you know, and he's obviously would be the obvious choice. And, you know, if you were taking bets, he'd be the person you would imagine would be the next in line to be leader. But we do know that he did apply for another job. He applied for the Children's Commissioner's job, which would make you think, does he consider that his life, his future is in politics long term?
But I've heard this all morning, right? About, does that mean Robbie couldn't do the job? And I think it was McGimsey, you, Chris, who said this on Good Morning Ulster. You know, in the real world, people think about leaving a job. They look at their prospects. Sometimes they actually put it up to their employer. I'm leaving if I don't get this. And then they stay in the job. This narrative I've heard in the media this morning, oh, well, that means he's maybe not interested. It meant that he was looking at another opportunity last year and he could be just as interested now as he ever has been.
Well, yeah, well, I think... Sorry, Alison. It was me, yes. I said that will be his Achilles heel because that gives the impression that he
had something. It does.
Well, it does. I mean,
well, I've looked at other jobs over the last 20 years outside the BBC. At one stage, I wanted to be a teacher. At one stage, I was going to go to ITV. Didn't go. And I'm as committed to the BBC now as I ever was. Like, where is this artificial, some people could argue, waffle that somebody in politics looks at a job outside and all of a sudden they're not committed?
No, well, I wouldn't be following that argument. I'm saying that's his Achilles heel. A lot of people will feel that, and I think that will not help him when he's appealing. If he decides to go for the leader, can I just make a point?
Yeah.
The Ulster Unions Party does not have a deputy leader. Okay, what we have is a leader, and we also have a leader and a deputy leader of the Assembly Party. So if you wanted to be deputy leader of the Assembly Party, you just have to get included.
Okay.
That's actually quite
final word to you, Alison.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it'll be interesting. It'll be, you know, there's a few wild cards as well. John Stewart's name has come up in terms of maybe a potential party leader. But I do think if we just have a rehash and you know, we just bring back one of the leaders from the past who didn't manage to make things work, it's not really a good sign in terms of the future or the resilience.
Mike Nesbitt didn't rule himself out.
Well, he hasn't considered it, and he has a pretty important job right now to be getting on with as well.
I think Mike Nesbitt might well be prepared to sacrifice himself if he thought there was a possibility of winning. Robbie Butler,
what's that mean?
Difficulty. Let's just wait and see.
What do you mean sacrifice himself? What's that mean?
I'm being funny.
What does it mean?
What I mean is, I think I wouldn't totally rule out Mike Nesbitt coming back because he loves the party and he wants to help.
Would you support him coming back?
Personally, I would not be supportive of Mike Nesbitt. But
why not?
Robbie Butler's drawback is that he's always concentrated in the east of the province, and he's almost unknown in the west of the province, and where most of our delegates come from.
Why wouldn't you support Nesbitt coming back?
Well, I think Nesbitt came in at a time we had a very good council election result, and over those few years, I mean, have a look at the results of the party during Mike's leadership. They were disastrous, and he was eventually met by Jim Nicholson and a couple of other officers who called him party headquarters and told him to go away. So, I mean, critical. Yeah, that's all in the press. That's all in the press there was a meeting in party headquarters, and he was told to leave not even on the Monday, but to leave on the weekend.
This is the man your party trusts so much. He's the health minister.
Well, of course, that's who Doug Beattie trusted to be the health minister, but you have to have someone. And I personally, one thing where I think Doug Beattie was absolutely right and he should have been supported was the idea that the Ulster Unionist Party should go into opposition, be leader of the opposition, and fight for our policies from the backbenchers and not to have one okay. front bencher.
Chris, thank you very much. Alison, thank you very much. What's it like then to be pushed? Chris McGimsey there, and again, Mike Nesbitt will have a different version of events possibly about what happened to him during the leadership, and we want to be fair to him this morning. But what's it like to be top dog and then to be pushed? Well, Jim Wells, former DUP MLA, we mentioned health there. He was pushed out of the health brief. What's it feel like, Jim, to lose the game?
With Doug Beattie, it's after 15 years. With me, it was after 43 years. And I'm interested in your comment, and I do believe that the scoop you had about Geoffrey Donaldson approaching the Ulster Unionist Party was true. Had they accepted
Geoffrey? I don't know. Just to be clear, I want to tell you exactly what I know. I don't know who approached who, but I'm telling you as 100% fact that Geoffrey Donaldson and Doug Beattie were in talks about Geoffrey defecting to the UUP. Fact.
And I accept that as fact, Stephen. Now, had Geoffrey accepted those approaches, then I would still be the DUP MLA for South Down, because if Geoffrey, as party leader, decided to dump me, after 43 years, I found that quite difficult to take. Though I have to also say that having been out for 2.5 years, I'm now quite content in my role as a grandfather and a carer for my wife. But it is difficult, particularly when it's done by someone who's just come in as leader, to turn around and say, well, the first decision I'm going to take is to get rid of that awkward character, Wells. He's only been around for 43 years, but sure, so what? And that's what happened. But
Stephen, that's not just what happened, was it? This was Peter Robertson was in charge, was he not?
Well, yes, but it was actually...
And these were after your comments about, well-rehearsed comments about homosexuality, Jim.
Yes.
So they didn't just do it on a whim.
Yes, but comments where a judge ruled that the lady who made them completely made them up, and that in fact I was completely innocent. Not that the party recognised that, but
I don't think a judge did rule that, Jim. But look, that's for another day,
well,
isn't it?
Well, I can send you the transcript, okay. Stephen, if that helps you.
Right.
But what I can say to you, Stephen, is Enoch Powell famously said that all political careers end in tears, and that's a fact. You think of people like Mark Durkan, Katrina Rohan, Martin Mullier, Danny Kennedy, all great powerhouses of the relative parties, and it all ended, it crashed around their ears. And why should I be any more surprised that this happened to me? It's going to happen to Doug. But the fundamental problem with Doug Beattie is Doug Beattie tried to move the Ulster Unionist Party onto Lands Party territory, and it just did not work, because those who were of that ilk, who are vast majority of them are unionists, it's a small U, preferred the alliance. And I remember seeing a leaflet in one of the constituencies saying, vote for the Ulster Unionist Party for more LGBT representation at Stormont. Now, when you think of the party of Molyneux and McCusker and McGuinness and Smith, that would be a complete anathema to them and to many traditional...
But you've been back for so many years, a party's got to keep up with the times.
Yes, but that, one of the MLAs from Fermanagh, I think it's Barlow, I think was the lady was called. She said that that just does not ring with the Ulster Unionist support, particularly west of the Bann, where the bulk of the delegates and the bulk of the money comes from. So people sitting in Fermanagh, West Tyrone, and Urien Armagh did not gel with that particular policy. He led them onto his party territory. They were very badly defeated. And don't consider Robin Swan to be a UUP victory. Robin Swan was a personal vote. Robin Swan, many would believe, excelled as Minister of Health during a very difficult period, and the people of Southampton recognised him, that he had qualities. But you cannot translate that into being a victory
okay.
for the Ulster Unionist Party.
Jim, thank you very much indeed. It is noted that you have not wished me a happy birthday this morning, but Big Barbara, I think, is going to do so. Good morning, Big Barbara.
Good morning, Stephen. I would not forget your birthday, dear.
Can you imagine? Well, sir, he didn't even mention
many,
it.
Many, many more.
Not even a word from him about my birthday.
Not a word from anybody. I was just sitting listening to you all morning there, and I just had to ring in myself and wish you the happy birthday. Now you're 51, aren't you?
And Barbara, I'm shocked. I am shocked to the core.
I know, not none of your friends or anything.
Well, here's the score. They're not my friends, but I cannot believe that the First Minister of this country, Michelle O'Neill, not one shinner has offered me a happy birthday message. Not Gerry Kelly. I see him all the time over in the Boucher Road. Never see him. Never a happy birthday. Gavin Robinson, I pass him every day when he's walking his shih tzu. Not one happy birthday message from him. What's going on?
Well, you know how to treat them. It's when it's their birthday, just walk past them and hear.
Norman and Bangor, good morning. We're going back to the founder members of the Nolan Show here.
Stephen, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Stephen. Happy birthday to you. Stephen.
Yes.
I was in Torquay and I was thinking of you. You remember I talked to you about Blackpool, the dummy tit rocks
the
on the end
tits.
Of a dog day.
Yes.
I seen them in Torquay and I said, I should have brought Stephen.
I love those
one
things. I love sucking those. I really do. The big red ones. I love
yes.
them.
You could wear it around your neck or take it for a walk, Stephen.
Oh,
but Stephen,
dear.
Have a great day on your birthday. You deserve it, so you do.
Just waiting. My team bought me a birthday cake. I'm afraid I need to get a taster in case they put poison in it.
Oh, either way, out of steam, you'll be all right. So, yeah, well, you'll be catching up with me soon.
51 now, Norman. I've got that's when
you've a bit to go to me.
That's when the hairs start growing out of your ears.
I know, my mind's growing.
Right. Thank you, Norman.
Right, Stephen.
Thanks.
Have a great day.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow for more Nolan at 9.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. We're in Chicago for a passing of the torch at the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden has urged Americans to elect Kamala Harris as his replacement. But what will President Biden do with the time he has left in office? And what is the legacy he wants to leave? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.